This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Endless record heat over Asia, strange spring heat waves from Spain to Botswana. Is it because the ocean has never been hotter? Then Katrin Ganswich from Urgewald names the trillion-dollar pension funds and investment houses paying for this new surge in fossil fuel production. Psychologist Derek Sabri Jr. on the African-American experience during the climate shift. We cover the world. This is Radio EcoShock.
More on the heat waves in India and other parts of Asia. Weather watchers describe it as the worst April heat wave in Asian history.
That's right. Weather stations are logging a sea of red as temperatures hit record highs. China, India, Bangladesh, and Southeast Asia all seeing rising temperatures. And scientists say global warming is exacerbating the adverse weather. And experts warn that the heat will hit the poor the hardest, especially those without access to cooling or adequate shelter.
Over a billion people sweltered through an April heat wave that broke record after record across that region. Extreme heat was cooking in Pakistan and India, where 12 people at an outdoor rally died in the heat.
The last 8 years have been the warmest ever recorded, according to a new report released by the World Meteorological Organization.
Almost half of India's population works outdoors and must work to eat.
It's unusually hot this year. It's hotter than any other year, and it makes my job harder. I feel like I can pass out at any minute.
Damage to the crops there is still being assessed. Extreme heat combined with big city air pollution in both India and Thailand made a deadly brew. So far in 2023, over a million Thai people sought medical treatment for breathing problems in the smog and heat. Schools have been closed in several countries.
There's just no doubt that climate extremes are really in our face. Now there's just so many happening that people can't keep up, in a sense. And you keep hearing about record-breaking events over and over and over again.
All right, for more on the heat wave and its impact, let's speak now with David Caroli. He's a professor emeritus in the School of Geography, Earth, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Melbourne.
Well, let's maybe start back a little bit. It is quite normal for extreme temperatures to occur in towards the end of the dry season, heading into the wet season in many parts of South and Central Asia. And so heat waves at this time of year are unusual, but particularly what's happened this year is the extreme nature of these heat waves, as you've described already in India, in Bangladesh, in China. And those extreme temperatures are being exacerbated by climate change. Climate change is increasing the risks of extreme temperatures, making the heat waves more frequent and more intense.
The heat block spread across Southeast Asia with more record extremes. According to Rebecca Ratcliffe in The Guardian, April 27, new heat records were set across, quote, Thailand, Myanmar, Laos, and Vietnam, as well as in China and South Asia, end quote. Health authorities in Thailand advise citizens to stay home. Temperatures in Bangkok reach 42 degrees C, about 107 Fahrenheit, but combined with the high humidity there, this felt like 54 degrees C. That is 129 degrees Fahrenheit. That's pretty hard to take.
A deadly heat wave is silently killing lives and livelihoods and impacting more people than we care to acknowledge. The numbers are scary. Almost half of India's workers work outdoors. They are at risk. The loss in GDP is monumental. Even Nepal and China are reporting temperatures above 40 degrees. People are dying. This is not a weather story anymore. It is hurting your health. It is hurting your body and the economy of your country.
According to the climatologist and weather historian Maximiliano Herrera, Laos hit the highest reliable temperature in its history last week. Experts are calling this the worst heat wave in Asian history, and it has been cooking the region for weeks. It's just sticking around. The future has arrived.
Well, to other news, and a heat wave is moving across Southeast Asia, pushing temperatures to record levels. In India, at least 11 people died of heat stroke this week. Schools and colleges in some provinces have been closed.
Well, Bangladesh is seeing its highest temperatures in almost 60 years, and seasonal rains have so far failed to appear. Regions across China are reporting record April highs and many wildfires, with the hottest months of the year still to come. In Thailand, the mercury surpassed 45 degrees Celsius for the first time ever on Friday. Climate experts there warn the extreme heat and drought may last for months. Well, we're going to go to Tanvir Chowdhury, who is coming to us from the Bangladesh capital of Dhaka. And is there any respite at all there at this point in time, Tanvir?
Other extreme hotspots have popped up all over the planet in recent weeks. You probably heard about Sahara-like heat washing over Spain last week. It was over 16 degrees, about 29 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than in previous years. It is unprecedented in Spain. In the southern African country of Botswana, they recorded the hottest April day ever seen. It should be the start of the cold season there, not 40 degrees C or 104 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. All of this excess heat is coming during a La Niña year, which is supposed to be cooler. And it comes before an expected change to an El Niño event next winter, which could make it even hotter. We know the ultimate cause of all this. Humans have changed the atmosphere with our fossil fuel emissions and by damaging the natural carbon cycle with things like deforestation. But are the hotter oceans also driving this recent heat on land? Let's take a look at those ocean heat waves.
Alert, alert. Ocean heat wave.
The BBC client and science team just published an alarming story about recent rapid ocean warming. I found it upsetting. BBC authors Matt McGrath and Mark Poynting say, quote, "Several scientists contacted for this story were reluctant to go on record about the implications. One spoke of being extremely worried and completely stressed," end quote. When your scientists freak out, it is time to pay attention. The article contains a map from the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts. It shows average sea surface temperatures in 2011 to 2020 compared to 1951 to 1980. The world's oceans appear to have developed a heat rash, a fever. The worst is around the far north, but the seas along the coasts of Alaska, New England, Kamchatka, and China are sizzling too, up to 2 degrees C warmer than in the previous decades. That doesn't sound like much, but it indicates vast amounts of energy added to the oceans. But now in the news, even hotter marine heat waves are laid over that map of longer-term averages. The North Pacific and the North Atlantic have a marine fever for sure. According to a new study by Karina von Schuckmann and 67 co-authors, and I quote the BBC here, over the past 15 years, the Earth has accumulated almost as much heat as it did in the previous 45 years, with most of the extra energy going into the oceans, end quote. In decades of measuring temperatures, world oceans have never been hotter than in April 2023. Think about that. A new global record ocean heat. As I mentioned, there are worse spots laid on top of that. The BBC article says, quote, "In March, sea surface temperatures off the east coast of North America were as much as 13.8 degrees C higher than the 1981 to 2011 average," end quote. Well, the Maine lobster fishers know about that, and they're plenty worried. To be clear, the record sea temperatures set in March and April do not come from the von Schuckmann paper. A number of media outlets quote figures from the open access and real-time services like climateanalyzer.org and nullschool.net, and those are based on satellite measurements, so they're pretty reliable. For example, Sam Karana at the Arctic News blog uses nullschool to find, quote, "sea surface temperatures off the east coast of North America as much as 13.8 degrees C or 28.5 higher than 1981 to 2011. And that was for the date March 15th. One caution here. While a flare-up has occurred, care is needed when picking a certain place in the world on just one day or during a month. We do not know the total influences beyond global heating that create these anomalies. Von Schuckmann's paper also notes these unknowns. It is happening, she says, but the mechanisms and the proof still have uncertainty.
Radio EcoShock.
I have been covering the ocean heat story here on Radio EcoShock for years. In the last 3 years, top scientist Kevin Trenberth has appeared a half dozen times to explain the extent and risks of making the ocean hotter. The risks are so huge, we can barely comprehend them, including more sea level rise, faster polar ice melt, mass deaths of marine species, including corals, harsher hurricanes and other typhoons in extreme weather, and the approaching state where the sea can take up less of our carbon dioxide pollution. If that carbon capture facility drops from the sea, even a little, all of the carbon we put into the sky will heat us pretty directly. We lose the ocean protective buffer. Not good. VOA, Voice of America, did some good reporting on this ocean warming story. Quoting their April 17th article, "Sudden ocean warming spike stirs concern." This is an unusual pattern. This is an extreme event at a global scale in areas that don't fit merely an El Nino, said Princeton University climate scientist Gabe Vecchi. This is a huge, huge signal. I think it's going to take some level of effort to understand it. The University of Colorado scientist Karnauskas took global sea surface temperatures anomalies over the past weeks and subtracted the average temperature anomalies from earlier to see where the sudden burst of warming is the highest. He found a long stretch across the equator from South America to Africa, including both the Pacific and Indian Oceans, responsible for much of the global temperature spike. That area warmed 0.4°C in just 10 to 14 days, which is highly unusual, Karnauskas said. Since that last El Nino, the global heat ocean content has increased 0.04°C or 0.07°F. Which may not sound like a lot, but, quote, "it's actually a tremendous amount of energy," Perkey said. "It's about 30 to 40 zettajoules of heat, which is the energy equivalent of hundreds of millions of atomic bombs the size that leveled Hiroshima," she said. And that ends a quote from Voice of America. This fast-developing situation in sea heat is well known to science. Almost every month, another major study comes from institutes all over the world working hard on this threat. Not everyone thinks this time right now is a big strike. For example, Professor Michael Mann from the University of Pennsylvania says this is expected as a developing El Nino adds to the steady drumbeat of emissions from our stacks and tailpipes. I'm not sure we should panic about a particular ocean heat wave, but let's panic about the whole trend. On the other hand, there is a growing chorus of scientists who worry Earth's temperature will not ramp up by so many tenths of a degree per decade, but could jump up in steps and stay there. It is too early to say with certainty whether this will be a strong El Nino year. The signs are there, but spring is a notoriously bad time to predict even next winter's weather. After 3 years of La Nina, some kind of El Nino seems likely. Even if that develops in the fall of 2023, there is a lag time, meaning 2024 could be the hottest year you have ever lived. These La Niña El Niño systems, called ENSO, they come and go. But Dr. Trenberth told us in an interview last September, human-forced warming has overwhelmed that ocean heat cycle. Global warming is now stronger than ENSO, whatever its state might be. You know the rest. Whether we take this planet to the burning level, too hot for mammals and most of our living friends, depends on us. If we go on looking for normal, exploring and pumping more fossil fuels, being happy in the burning party, mass extinction will happen. We could choose survival instead. Our next guest, Katrin Godsvind, will tell you who is paying to pump up the heat. And it could be you. Then Derek Sebree Jr. gives us the African-American experience.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Last week on Radio EcoShock, we revealed terrible news. Big banks are financing a new surge of climate-killing fossil fuels, But the banks are dwarfed by institutional investors, including your pension funds, university endowments, insurance giants, and more. We are talking about trillions of dollars poured into more oil, gas, and coal. It is midnight for climate change. Do you know where your money is? You can find out, thanks to a new free online database created by a coalition of nonprofit groups. We can find out where financial power really lives. Our guide is Katrin Ganswit, head of finance research for the famous German environment group Ergewald. We are in good hands. From Germany, Katrin Ganswit, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're really welcome. I'm glad to have you. When we talked last November, you warned oil, gas, and coal companies have announced enough expansion to break the future. Is that coming true? Is there really a surge in fossil fuel expansion right now when we need it least?
So the surge in fossil fuel expansion didn't stop so far, even if we announced as NGOs that it really needs to stop, and not only us, yeah, climate science, even the International Energy Agency says so, but we don't see especially oil and gas companies stopping to explore for new oil and gas resources. They're still on it.
Okay, and how much fossil fuel investment money are we talking about with your report?
So in our report, we identified more than $3 trillion U.S. dollars held by asset managers, banks, also pension funds, insurance companies, retirement schemes from all over the world.
And just to understand, are the big oil and gas companies expanding existing sites, or are they exploring and developing more production across the world?
Unfortunately, they do both. So first of all, there is something which we call short-term expansion. So this is reserves which will come into production pretty soon, depending on the kind of reserve, in a year, in 3 years, maybe in 7 years for very complicated forms of production, but before 2030, definitely. That's on the one hand. That's what, yeah, more than 90% of the companies in the oil and gas sector are doing. And then additionally, most of the companies are still also looking for new oil and gas resources. So for resources which will only come into production in the long term, in a time where the reduction of fossil fuel use should have happened already. That's for oil and gas. For coal, it's a bit less, especially if you look for new reserves, depending on what kind of expansion you're looking at. Let's say maybe it's less than half of the industry. So there we definitely see a decline in the coal industry, but oil and gas is still going ahead like they used to.
And a key question becomes, who is providing countless billions of dollars to expand oil and gas from the Arctic to the Amazon, and who is in control of that money? Why don't we begin with what you call the Terrible Two? Who are they, and why do their decisions matter to the world?
The Terrible Two are, in fact, two U.S. companies and the biggest two private asset managers on this planet. It's Vanguard and BlackRock. And it is in this order, despite BlackRock being the biggest asset manager and Vanguard, so to say, only number two. So Vanguard is the number one fossil fuel investor. And that fits very well because Vanguard made very clear that they don't think divestment does make any sense for them, and they also walked away from the Net Zero Asset Manager Alliance they've been part of so far. BlackRock, on the other hand, in a way, they're only second, but it's not a big difference. It's around $5 billion U.S. dollars, which is not a lot for them. BlackRock is usually, so Larry Fink, as part of the Glasgow Financial Alliance Initiative, they usually talk about being more progressive, more green, being fit in ESG, but in the end, they're still the second biggest investor in fossil fuels. And if you look at coal developers, so companies which are still building new power plants or creating new mines, here BlackRock is actually the number one investor.
Yeah, some of those companies play a game where they say, well, we're not investing in coal mining, but, oh, yes, we are lending a lot of money to coal power companies and transportation companies and all the other parts of that chain.
Yeah, that's true. So they say not coal. I mean, BlackRock has a coal policy or implemented a coal policy, but it was only directed to revenues from thermal coal mining, so a very particular part of the coal industry, and one which, especially at the time where this policy was implemented, was not really doing good. Metallurgical coal you could still make money with, but making money with thermal coal was really hard at that time, and a few U.S. coal mining companies were also on the rim of bankruptcy, Peabody, I think, being the most well-known. So you felt it was more an argument of BlackRock to get rid of assets which were not doing good anyway and, painting themselves green at the same time. And we had a look back then when Larry Fink announced this divestment. We had a look at how big this share from the coal industry was, and we reached at about, depending on how you count it, 17-18%. So less than 20% of the industry was what BlackRock committed to divest from. And anyway, they only divested from their actively managed funds. So everything which was passive investment, which is the biggest share of BlackRock's business, was not taken into account anyway.
All kinds of climate games being played by these companies while they claim to be green.
So, of course, it's a question of good reputation if you're climate friendly or not. The general understanding, even if there's, of course, counterparts or people would say something else, but the general understanding in the sphere of science, in the sphere of civil society, and also in the sphere of financial industry is clear, okay, there needs to be some climate commitments to still be part of the game. How these climate commitments are and how impactful they are, that's still really the question. And we still think the Glasgow Financial Alliance on Net Zero is a good example because it started off as a tricky but maybe promising initiative, UN convened but industry led, and NGOs had different ideas if this initiative would mean anything and would lead to anything, but we were hopeful. But so far, we don't see a lot of progress. We see, as said, important participants with a big volume, like Vanguard, walking away from the initiative. Last but not least, also because of the anti-ESG laws in the United States. That's at least what they say. And we don't see a big impact. We still see the big investors and banks supporting the fossil industry, and they usually try to calculate their emissions and then talk about emission reductions, but clear cuts, divestment after, let it be some time of engagement, but then a clear time where you say, now in this case we have to divest if the company hasn't a good transition plan. You don't see this for the oil and gas industry especially.
So the investigation by your consortium of concerned groups found 23 big institutional investors provided about half of all the investments on fossil fuel companies. We think climate will be decided by politicians. That's the game. But really, the CEOs and stockholders of just 23 companies could be in control of our future. We should know who they are. And does your new project help us find that out?
Yeah, definitely. Also, first of all, as you mentioned, our webpage on investinginclimatechaos.org, you can find a report where you easily find the top investors, and they're displayed. Many of them are from the U.S., but you also find pension funds like the pension fund from Japan or Norway on the list, and the National Pension Service of Korea, the Life Insurance Corporation of India, and also if you look at U.S. companies, even though they're private, some of them, like, for example, the TIAA is a pension scheme in the end. So, yes, these companies don't only hold the money for your retirement, but they also decide to invest it into something which destroys the future of the planet and definitely also an easygoing retirement. So you have this overview on our webpage, but you also have a place where you can explore the data and look for the country of your interest, for the kind of company of your interest, for the investor of your interest, and can really check out what the companies in your country or the investor where you might have your retirement money is invested in.
Yes, you talk about national pension funds. And, you know, in the U.S., investors account for about 64% of investing in fossil fuel companies, according to your great big study. And it appears like America alone could save the world climate from outright disaster if those investment companies would agree and act responsibly. But it seems like the government is split, the population is split. Do you see hope that Americans are going to come around and really act to save the climate through these money flows?
Good question. As you said, it is split. And I mentioned already this anti-ESG law in the U.S. where you already see impacts basically on a global level because you had all the discussion of this. Yeah, you have the discussion within the networks of the GFIN's Alliance of can American banks still be committed if they have this pressure in their home country. And let's say, of course, Americans still can. I mean, we'll see what future brings, but we definitely hope also American society, the majority of American society, will in the end support climate law if they see the impacts. And I mean, the U.S. is a country which sees the impacts. Many parts of the U.S. see droughts, see flood. They actually see what climate change is doing. And that's why I'm hopeful at some point also U.S. Americans, like I hope the same here for everyone in Europe, will understand there need to be changes in the system, how we work, how we invest, where we put our money, and how we frame our industry if we want to stop runaway climate change.
I remember a few years ago, Greenpeace Germany put up billboards with faces of executives they called climate criminals. And maybe it's time for some new billboards and social media campaigns to put faces on the companies that you outline in your report. Does that sound too extreme?
No, I don't think that sounds too extreme to me. I mean, the conditions we are at right now are really extreme, and I think that means extreme measures are needed to have a quick change. I mean, the changes we need don't only need to be quick, they also need to be tremendous, and they need to be more tremendous the less time we have. So you have to have impactful campaigns. And yes, I do think that the CEOs, the heads, the leadership of all these investors we're talking about have more opportunity than they admit in changing the way they invest. And this will, of course, mean, as you especially also talk about the American population, not all of the citizens will be happy about it, and maybe not all of the customers will be happy about it, and maybe some will walk to a more climate criminal investor. But the more investors and the more banks which walk on the climate path and start walking away from fossil fuel companies, the less space there will be for these companies to just go to a different funder. And I believe that this is possible. Otherwise, I wouldn't do my job.
We talked about pension savings, and that really worries me because people are trying to save for their old age, but their old age may be wrecked by climate disasters one after another, and it's even worse for their kids if they ever hope to leave some money to their kids. And, you know, your retirement plan in America, the 401k, you're kind of forced through a government action to be investing in stocks, and this money flows up to BlackRock and up to Vanguard and other investment funds. Is there anything that ordinary workers can do to stop funding destruction of their own future with their saving money?
Yeah, I think therefore you might need to explain a bit more about the retirement scheme in the U.S. because I would say you look for a different provider in Europe. I'm not sure. This sounded like you're stuck if you're working for a specific company. You're stuck with their retirement scheme.
But you could get together with the other workers and say, look, these are our terms. No money goes to climate wrecking. That's the best I've got. And I'm going to look up some more about pension activism in the U.S. because it gets really complicated, because when people die younger, and they will die younger with climate change, life insurance companies make less money. But the pension funds, they have to pay out less when clients die younger. So climate deaths actually save them money. So it's a conflict, a real conflict for any pension fund to finance products that is deadly for its clients. And I don't hear people talking about this.
Okay. So what workers do is first they should make it public. They should talk about it. They should bring it out there so more of their colleagues know about it, and then they can get together and do something against it and say, we don't like these conditions which are killing our future, or maybe us, or at least our children. We want to have our retirement money invested in something which is keeping our future. And this would be the answer.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio.